Amen. All right. So we are in a series called Pain into Purpose, and if this is your first time with us, I'll give you just a brief rundown of what we've been doing. We're talking about how suffering plays a role in our spiritual formation. Sanctification is the process of God making us more like Christ as we follow him and as we are apprentices or disciples under Christ. He asked us to follow him. As we follow him, we believe through that process, he actually makes us more like him. We don't ever become him. We are still us. We don't become divine, but we can imitate him by his Holy Spirit in a way that maybe isn't possible on our own. And we believe that suffering, or at least I believe, I hope that I have convinced you of this so far. I don't know why this is here. This is going to bug me. That suffering plays a role in our spiritual formation, in that God can use it to grow us spiritually. Y'all with me? All right. So if you're just joining us in this study, we've been studying suffering and pain through the life of Joseph in the book of Genesis. And this is like, I don't know, week 5 or something now. It's funny, by the way, our teaching series go a lot faster now that we're every Friday night. I'm like, wow, we're really, I can't drag teaching series out like 6 months anymore like I used to, and it was like once a month or twice a month. So yeah, we're really cooking through. We're in chapter 42, but we started this series in Genesis 37, where we pick up on Joseph as a young man who is betrayed and ultimately abandoned by his 10 older brothers, who sell him as a slave, yes, sell him into slavery to passing traders. They're jealous of him. They don't like him. He's daddy's favorite. And so they get rid of him. And this one painful incident, this moment that his brothers decide to attack him and to sell him, this is a defining moment in Joseph's life. He faces more opposition, of course, that we've covered over the last few weeks. You know, he's falsely accused of assault. He's thrown in prison. He's forgotten. He's abandoned. But last week, we read chapter 41, how Joseph is brought out of prison by Pharaoh himself and asked to interpret Pharaoh's dream. And Joseph hears from God. He interprets Pharaoh's dream, and he tells him, this is what God says. There's going to be 7 years of abundance followed by 7 years of famine. Abundance, we're not talking about the stock market climbing, we're talking about increase in agriculture. So good years for good harvest. We're going to have plenty of food, but then after that there's going to be some sort of drought and the Nile is going to run really low and there won't be enough crops for people to eat. And so Joseph says, this is what God says is going to happen. And not only does Joseph tell them this is what's happening, but he also proposes a plan. He's like, and what you can do about it is this. I didn't mention this last week, by the way, but I was dying. Every time I read when Joseph is talking to Pharaoh, Joseph slips in the little, I think you should pick someone really wise and discerning to head up this food storage project. You know, it's kind of like, pick me, pick me. And Pharaoh does, right? So Joseph slides in his little pitch, gives him his resume, and Pharaoh's like, yes, okay, I haven't had anyone discern dreams or apply wisdom in this way. And so Joseph becomes, by the hand of God on his life, he becomes a governor, a leader. He becomes second in command, essentially, of Egypt, as the text says. He has a wife, he has a family, he has influence, he has security, he has prosperity. And so after all of these chapters of suffering, and after all of these years, 13 years of Joseph's life being in toil and trial, and all he can do through those 13 years is submit to God and trust God. And then Genesis 41 is kind of that payoff we've been waiting for, definitely that Joseph's waiting for, where he steps into his purpose, and now we begin to see some of the good that God can create out of all the suffering that he's been through up to this point. And even though Joseph went through all of this pain and all of this discomfort and all of this suffering, God ended up having him right where he needed to be when he needed to be there, right? That's where we left off last week. That's not the end of Joseph's story, though, because the worst situations of Joseph's life technically are over, but he isn't done dealing with them yet. He isn't done dealing with his past. Come on, like, can anyone relate to that? Like, you've been through it. It's technically over, but you're still picking up the pieces. You're still sorting through them. You're still trying to find healing. You're still trying to find peace. You're still trying to find purpose. So the message I want to give to you tonight, I'm calling the other side. The other side. Let's talk a little bit tonight about when pain is no longer fresh, but it's also not fully gone. Have you ever broken a bone? Anybody? Okay, We're the lucky three, I guess. Who, if I was telling someone this week, I think breaking a bone is like the most painful injury you can have. It's just brutal what happens to your body when your bone breaks. It's so painful. When I was in fifth grade, Randy's suddenly hating this illustration. When I was in fifth grade, jaw just dropped. I broke my arm on the playground at school, and you know how they have those big metal, whatever those play sets are that kids run around on, and of course we weren't allowed to run around on them, but we did anyway, so no tag, but we were playing tag, and my buddy shoved me off because the person who was it was coming up, and I fell and shattered my elbow, multiple breaks, and it was so, so painful. I had surgery on it. I still have two surgical scars. I had like metal pins in my elbow to keep my arm together. It was terrible. Now, this broken arm that I suffered was roughly, I don't know, more than 20 years ago. Let's not do the math, but more than 20 years ago. That arm is now healed, yeah? But it's not the same. A doctor could look at my elbow, I'd go into a doctor and say, is this a healthy elbow? And they would say, yes, your elbow is fine. But I know it doesn't quite work the same since that happened, and I know that it probably never will. It's weaker, it's sensitive, it's scarred, it's healed, but it's not the same. And in the same way, we may move on from a season of suffering, we may move on from a hard year, or from a loss, or from a disappointment, and we'll get to the other side, but the other side is never the same place as where we started. Yeah, suffering changes you. Whether it be sickness, or loss, or heartbreak, or persecution, when you come out on the other side, you come out different. I think sometimes we think of suffering and healing as these events, like these things just occur at certain points in time. In reality, both suffering and healing are often process. They are processes. And that's not a bad thing, because we don't always come out on the other side damaged and weaker. No, we may actually, by the grace of God, come out on the other side stronger. We come out on the other side full of faith, or as James points out in James 1, that we would come out with greater perseverance built up. And so the other side isn't just about a happily ever after. It's about continuing to trust God through a process of healing and maybe even adaptation to changes in your life. Like, things are different now, but what can God do in what's different now after I have gone through this suffering and I've gotten to the other side? And so maybe for some of you in the room tonight, these next chapters of Joseph's life are not very relevant to you. Maybe it's not too applicable. Maybe for some of you, talking about going to the other side, getting to the other side of your suffering feels so far off. It feels like, what are you talking about? And we're reading about Joseph has all this money and he has a family, and you can't relate to that. And maybe you resonate a lot more with last week, Joseph in prison, saying, what is the point of all this, than you do Joseph in Egypt, all rich and happy. Well, I've said it in almost every one of these messages, usually in the introduction, so I'll say it one more time. No matter where we are, all of us, and no matter what we're facing, the lessons of this text still apply, and this series is valuable for all of us, no matter where we are at on this journey, in this process. Whether we're going through a trial right now, or whether things are going good, that means we're preparing for a trial. Whether we're accepting healing right now, or whether we're waiting for it, and whether we're praying for it, it's not our job to say, what does the Bible have to say to me in this moment? That's not how we read the Bible, but rather we read the Bible to say, what is the Bible saying? What does it say? What does it say about God? And how does that inform me about who God is, how he loves me, and how he works in my life? And so that's what we're reading tonight. And so I believe this message will apply to everyone. Even if you're not to the other side yet, this message is for you. Ready to get into the scripture? Okay, good. Good. I heard your cries last week, and I have put the text back on the screen. So when Mariah boos me, I usually have to adapt. You didn't know. She basically booed me. Well, she told me later she forgot her phone and her Bible, and that was the night that I was like, no passage on the screen. And so here you go, Mariah. I got it for you. Okay, we're in Genesis 42. We're going to start with the first seven verses. Genesis chapter 42, verse 1, the Word of God says this. When Jacob learned there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, why do you just keep looking at each other? He continued, I have heard there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die. Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others because he was afraid that harm might come to him. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for there was famine in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. Okay, well, we'll pause there for a second. Okay, this is not the plan. Somebody say, this is not the plan. This is not what Joseph had in mind, and although the text doesn't tell us his thoughts on the matter, whether he considered it was possible he was going to see his brothers again or not, what we do definitely know is he named his firstborn son Manasseh, which means meaning to forget, and he said, I'm going to name my son Manasseh because I have forgotten my father's house. I've forgotten all of that past stuff and that hurt and that the Lord helped me to forget. So that tells us Joseph was not sitting in Egypt waiting for his chance at revenge, nor was Joseph waiting for his chance at restoration. Encountering his brothers again is seemingly a surprise, unexpected twist for him. This is something he did not intend for his life. And although it ends up a blessing, this little plot twist is born out of pain and even a little bit of panic. Okay. So hear me. The way that you move into your healing, the way that you expect to move into your healing may or may not be how you actually move into your healing. How you think it's going to go, how you think God's going to heal you may not actually be how he does. The journey to the other side may not be the course that you plotted. Come on, y'all, talk to me tonight. Has anyone experienced this? Do you know this? However you envision your healing, however you envision your breakthrough, it may not be like you envisioned. What I'm telling you, that God has a plan. God has a way for you. When you follow the Lord's will for your life, he always leads you forwards. Okay? The Lord's way is always forwards, even when, you follow this, it feels like you're going backwards, okay? And if you are confused about why God is taking you back, why he is taking you back to the people that hurt you, why God is bringing you back to the place of your regret, why God is bringing you back to the place of your pain or of your disappointment, okay, when God is backtracking you, he is actually fast-tracking you. I know that's cheesy, but bear with me. When it feels like God is moving you backwards, he is actually expediting you forward into something that you don't know you need to be in, or a place of healing that you didn't know to go yourself. Okay, so if God is having you confront something from your past, you already swore that off, you're like, no, I forgot about that, but then God's bringing you back into it. He is likely moving you forward into healing. So, although this encounter with his family will be good for Joseph, he didn't really plan on it. And I'm making this point, this is relevant because it's important to know why he kind of acts the way he does moving forward in the next few chapters. It might seem a little confusing. Joseph is like plotting and scheming and lying, but in reality, he is reacting and he is improvising. Joseph, at times, may not even be totally sure what he's doing. Like, he might not know what he's doing. I heard these stories in Sunday school, and it was always like Joseph was enacting this grand master plan, but I don't really think that's what's going on. I think Joseph tried to forget, and here on his doorstep are his 10 brothers back into his life. And now he's trying to figure out exactly how to handle it. And we're about to see Joseph is sort of an emotional wreck for the next four chapters. He's not this like calculating mastermind. He's working through his trauma and his pain. And so here his brothers show up in Egypt, and they're showing up just to buy food. And he recognizes them, and they don't recognize him. And the first thing he does is evaluating the situation. He doesn't want them to know who he is. He's been hurt by these men who he called his brothers, his family. And so he needs more information about who they are now and what's really going on. So picking up in I left off in the middle of verse 7, so back in 7, says that Joseph spoke harshly with him. Where do you come from, he asked. From the land of Canaan, they replied, to buy food. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dreams about them and said, you are spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected. "No, my lord," they answered. "Your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies." "No," he said to them, "you've come to see where our land is unprotected." But they replied, "Your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no more." Joseph said to them, "It's just as I told you, you are spies. And this is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison so that your words may be tested to see if you are telling the truth. If you are not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies." Then he put them all in custody for 3 days. So, because, seemingly, Joseph did not have a great plan on how to see his brothers, he doesn't really have great immediate execution of the solution here, of the situation. And so we need to read his actions accordingly with where he is at in his process of healing. Okay, as he's talking to them, it says suddenly things clicked in his mind. He remembers the dreams he had, and he realizes that those dreams are coming true. Now he actually has this authority over his brothers. He can supply them with food, or he can leave them starving. He can bless them, or he can enact revenge. And you got to understand that Joseph is battling with this tension in real time. This is why he hides his identity. This is why he accuses them of being spies. Like, obviously, they aren't spies, and he knows this. He's trying to get information from them. This is why he arrests them for a few days, trying to figure out what to do next. He comes up with this sort of haphazard plan of sending, only one of them back and keeping the rest. And what he wants here is for his youngest brother, Benjamin, to be brought back. And after having sort of prodded them a bit, he gets them to say who they are. And once they bring up their father and their youngest brother, that's the avenue he has to say, okay, in order to prove that you're not lying, bring Benjamin here. We've talked about Joseph and his 10 brothers quite a bit, but this is actually the first time that the text highlights the youngest brother, Benjamin. And Benjamin plays a really key role in the rest of the narrative, the next few chapters. So when Joseph begins his story here in Genesis 37, he is 17 years old, right? His brothers are actually not all that much older than him. His brothers are mostly in their 20s. Maybe the oldest, Reuben and Simeon, would have been in their late 20s, maybe early 30s. And the one that's not mentioned is Joseph's younger brother, Benjamin, who, when Joseph was 17, at the beginning of the story, Benjamin would have been around 5 or 6 years old. Between these 12 sons of Jacob, they have 4 different moms. So Jacob had 2 wives. That's sort of a long story. And then he also had kids with his wives, 2 maids. That's also sort of a long story we won't get into tonight. So of these 12 boys, they'll have 1 father, and they have 4 different mothers. And I know that Jacob doesn't come out looking great in this story, and unfortunately that actually does continue, which is a theme sometimes of the great patriarchs of faith in the Bible, but that's a completely different conversation. All that to say, this matters because Joseph and Benjamin share the same mom, Rachel. Rachel, who has passed away by this point in the text, was Jacob's favorite wife and it was the woman he loved and really the only woman he wanted to marry originally. And so Rachel had only 2 sons, Joseph and Benjamin. And this is a huge factor as to why Joseph and Benjamin are the favorites of Jacob, because they are the 2 sons of his favorite wife. Again, not justifying this, just noting it and explaining it. Okay, this is why. So when Joseph is sold into slavery at age 17, his younger brother Benjamin is just a small child, and Joseph has obviously not seen him since last he saw him. He was like 5. So here in verses 15 and 16, Joseph says, you need to bring your younger brother to prove you're not lying. He wants to see Benjamin. He wants to see the one brother who hasn't betrayed him. And the specifics of Joseph's intentions here and his overall plan, we don't really know because the text doesn't totally tell us what he's thinking. Could be a few things. It's possible he feared for Benjamin's life. He might have spent years and years worrying about him and praying for him, thinking about his little brother, thinking about the only son of their mom, Rachel, and worried that the same thing might happen to Benjamin that happened to him. If his brothers were so jealous of him, it stands to reason they might be jealous of Benjamin too, and what's to stop them from doing the same thing? So Joseph, likely, would stand to reason, has worried about his little brother for the last 20 years. It's also possible maybe he never even intended to reveal his identity to his brothers. Maybe this is just his plot to get Benjamin to him to keep him safe. and he intends to keep him there. At this point, you got to understand, he has no reason to trust his brothers. The last time that he saw them, 20 years ago, he was begging, crying for his life, and they ignored him and sold him as a slave to a passing caravan. So Joseph's primary concern is not for the older 10, it's for the youngest one. And he doesn't know anything that his brothers are telling him is true. He doesn't know if Jacob's really safe, or Benjamin's really safe. He doesn't know if Jacob's really alive. He doesn't know. And so, because he doesn't know, his first plan is to take control of the situation and force an outcome that he wants. I want you to see something here. Our pain, our path through our pain, and our journey through healing to the other side, it must always be God-led. Our journey to healing must always be God-led. And I've said a lot during this series that pain is really tricky because pain can drive us further from God, or pain can bring us closer to him. And it kind of depends on which other side we go to. And so submission to the Lord's will and to his path is crucial for our healing. When I take my healing into my own hands, then I control it how I want it. I become defensive. I focus on self-preservation. I become self-righteous against those who hurt me and those who let me down. And it becomes all about me and what I've been through and where I'm going. Trauma generally causes you to look back more than you probably should or would like to. When I was in college, this was 12 years ago, I got rear-ended on the freeway going into Portland, and it was one of those situations, slammed on my brakes and then had time to watch the car coming at me full speed and hit me. And that was well over a decade ago, but still, if I'm in little Maui traffic and if I have to slam on my brakes, I am more prone to look in my rearview mirror. I'm more worried about someone coming from behind to hit me than I am about hitting the person in front of me. When you're on a journey of healing, undealt with trauma in your past will take your eyes off of where you're going, and all too easily you will put them behind you. And for Joseph, because he is buried and he has denied his own trauma, see Manasseh, by the way, Manasseh's name, his first and primary concern here is that Benjamin doesn't face the same problem he faced, but this is a rearview mirror. And it's a noble concern, yes, but it has temporarily blinded him from being able to care about anyone else. His first plan to keep 9 brothers and to just send one to go get Benjamin, that probably would have doomed Jacob and the whole household. They would have starved because they needed 9 people to carry back the grain, or 10 people to. So it was a poor solution. But again, remember, Joseph is not enacting some master plan here. He is figuring out his life on the other side. And he is learning what it's like to deal with trauma and to submit it to God. My point here is that denying self-preservation is really crucial to healing. Choosing not to self-preserve, and I know it's the hardest thing in the world, when you've already been hurt, and then to choose to remain vulnerable. I know it's easier said than done. It's easy for me to say it up here. It's hard to do, and I wish I had the answer for this, how to do this. All I can say is this: the same faith that brought you through the valley must still be practiced on the journey up the mountain. The same faith that brought you to the darkness must still be lived and practiced in the light. The prayer you whispered in the darkness needs to be prayed in the daylight. The bread of life that sustained you on hard days needs to still be consumed on the easier days. The living hope you leaned on when you had nothing else needs to still be your support system when you can stand on your own. Trying to live on the other side while you're still focused on where you were and you're more worried about looking back than looking forward, that's how you become a bitter, guarded, and skeptic person. Life on the other side needs to be marked by the same dependence in God that got you to the other side in the first place. Y'all with me? Let's go to verse 19, maybe 18. Yeah, it's 18. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go and take back grain to your starving households. But you must bring your youngest brother to me so that your words may be verified and that you may not die." This they proceeded to do. They said to one another, "Surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come on us." Reuben replied, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy, but you wouldn't listen? Now we must give an accounting for his blood." They did not realize that Joseph could understand them, since he was using an interpreter. He turned away from them and began to weep, but then came back and spoke to them again. He had Simeon taken from them and bound before their eyes. A lot is happening here. Okay, let's break it down. Verse 21, after Joseph submits his plan to become God's plan, he comes back and says, "Okay, I'll let nine of you go and one stay rather than one of you go and nine stay." And facing this situation, this stress, verse 21, they said to one another, "Surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come on us." You know, we spent the last couple of months, almost months, of learning about Joseph, following his story. You know, he's kind of our hero. He's the main example of godly suffering and how spiritual formation is developed. But Joseph is not the only one who suffers in this story. He isn't the only one with trauma. 20 years later, his rough, tough brothers are still facing this tough situation. They are still haunted by what they did to Joseph all those years ago. Okay, remember, they assume Joseph is dead at this point. He's long gone. They have no clue that it's him in front of them. And yet, what is at the forefront of their minds? What are they thinking about? The sin that they committed against him decades ago. These men, they're now in their 40s and their 50s, and they're still in pain and deep regret over their own selfish, reckless, violent, hateful decision that they made against their brother all those decades ago. And they're still feeling it. Verse 22, Reuben has sort of a different twist on the trauma. Reuben says, "Didn't I tell you? I told you not to do this to him. But you wouldn't listen, and now we pay for his blood." If you remember back to part 1 in 37, Reuben is the one who intends to save Joseph from his brother's plot. Their first idea is to kill him. Reuben thinks, "I'll come and rescue him before they can kill him," and before he does so, they sell him off as a slave. And by the time that Reuben finds out, it's too late. So, yet a new level of trauma. Reuben has lived with the pain and the guilt for 20 years of knowing he didn't do enough to save his little brother. He knew what the right thing was, and he failed. Verse 23, they didn't realize Joseph could understand them, since he was using an interpreter. Verse 24 says, he turned away from them and began to weep. Joseph is about to cry a lot over the next few chapters, fair warning. So just a healthy side note for those of you living on the other side of suffering, crying is good. Joseph cried on the other side, and you can too. Look at this, though. This is key to Joseph's healing and to what comes next for him. Just the fact that he overheard this. He overhears his brothers having this conversation. They're blaming themselves for what they did, and he finds out Reuben tried to stop it, wanted to stop it, and either didn't or couldn't. And Joseph has spent the last 20 years probably wondering why they did what they did to him. Like, he has been through all this other suffering and all these other situations, but nothing cut deeper than what they did to him. And I know that he spent all the time since then wondering why. I'm sure he replayed it in his head countless times. You know, and him crying, begging for his life, them beating him, abusing him, ignoring his begging. He would have wondered, whose idea was it? Why didn't they try and stop it? Did they feel guilty? Did they regret it? Did they look back on it with pain, or did they forget him? Did they tell Jacob the truth? All these questions. And now, in this single moment, they have all these insights into, he has all these insights into the, what was the most tragic day of his life. And he finds out that the most traumatic day of his life was also his abuser's most traumatic day of their lives. What haunts him also haunts them. And that's not a consolation necessarily, but he learns in this moment they have deep regret over the actions against him. Now, I'll say, it is very possible to forgive someone when they have no regrets about hurting you. See Jesus. Okay, you can forgive someone who never apologizes and never shows any signs of remorse and never feels bad. Someone who turned their back on you or said something hurtful or left your life or let you down, it is possible to forgive. without getting that expression of regret. And I'm sure he could have done so too, but it's so powerful for Joseph in this moment. He actually doesn't have to face this reality. And the overwhelming emotion of all of this and this new realization about their regrets, it brings him to tears. So he cries, and then he comes back. And again, instead of, you know, keeping them all, he lets them all go and decides to keep one. He keeps Simeon and ties up Simeon and lets the rest go with the food that they purchased. And the choice to keep Simeon might seem a little bit random, but if we read into the text just a little bit, it's a little clearer. Reuben is, of course, the oldest, and he's the obvious choice to be the one that Joseph kept behind. But here's the thing. Now Joseph knows that Reuben argued for his life, that Reuben cared about him, and that Reuben has some semblance of honor. So Joseph likely now trusts Reuben more than the rest of his brothers to keep the peace and to honor the agreement and hopefully to bring Benjamin back. So instead of keeping the oldest, Joseph elects to keep the second oldest, Simeon. And we don't know a lot about Simeon, but the few things we do know are not great. There's a story in Genesis 37 where Simeon and his brother Levi are extremely violent and in a fit of revenge murder an entire town. Jacob's deathbed blessing to Simeon and Levi just a few chapters later, when Jacob is dying and he blesses all his sons of Simeon and Levi, he says, "Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel." So we don't know a ton about Simeon, but we know he was violent. We know he was impulsive. It's not impossible that Joseph viewed Simeon as someone who was prone to violence or instigation, who may have been taking part in some unfavorable action against Benjamin or the others, and maybe for that reason Joseph wanted to keep him there. But for whatever it was, Joseph ends up sending all of them but Simeon back to Jacob with the promise they'll return with Benjamin. We'll pick up in verse 25. Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain, to put each man's silver back in his sack, and to give them provisions for their journey. After this was done for them, they loaded their grain on their donkeys and left. At the place where they stopped for the night, one of them opened his sack to get feed for his donkey, and he saw his silver in the mouth of his sack. "My silver has been returned," he said to his brothers. "Here it is in my sack." Their hearts sank, and they turned to each other trembling and said, "What is this that God has done to us?" When they came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them. They said, "The man who is lord over the land spoke harshly to us, treated us as though we were spying on the land. But we said to him, 'We are honest men, we are not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of one father. One is no more, and the youngest is now with our father in Canaan.' Then the man who is lord over us, over the land, said to us, 'This is how I will know whether you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me and take food for your starving households and go. But bring your youngest brother to me so I will know that you are not spies but honest men. Then I will give your brother back to you and you can trade in the land.' As they were emptying their sacks, there in each man's sack was his pouch of silver. When they and their father saw the money pouches, they were frightened. Their father Jacob said to them, 'You have deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more, and now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me.' Then Reuben said to his father, 'You may put both of my sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Entrust him to my care, and I will bring him back.' But Jacob said, 'My son will not go down there with you. His brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm comes to him on the journey you are taking, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in sorrow.'" So Joseph agrees to, quote unquote, sell them grain, but he tells his workers put the money back in their bags. And when they realize this, they're terrified, thinking, of course, it's a mistake. And now when they go back, the Egyptians are going to accuse them of stealing. So they get back and they tell Jacob everything that's happened. And Jacob, if you couldn't tell, he's not having it. Jacob doesn't respond very favorably. And it's interesting, because although Jacob literally had incredible personal encounters with God, he had blessings on his life from God, he knew God personally, okay, and at this moment, he has no faith. Look at this. Their father Jacob said to them, "You've deprived me of my children. Joseph's no more. Simeon's no more. Now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me." Okay, the only one in this whole story that is not factoring God into the equation is actually Jacob. Ironically, as he's the patriarch, the man of God. But even Jacob has this trauma. And even Jacob is trying to get to the other side of something. So Jacob was not his father's favorite. Just like he plays this little favoritism game with his sons, his dad did the same. No, his father's favorite was his brother Esau. So to make up for this, Jacob, he plotted, he deceived, he lied in order to gain an inheritance that didn't belong to him. And the sad thing is that that's not just his story, but that he repeats that story. It's not just that he was loved less by his own father, it's that he commits those same sins against his sons. So he has his favorite son, Benjamin. He won't let him go. He's like, no way, you're taking my boy. Which, by the way, side note, Benjamin is a grown adult at this point. Okay, I always kind of heard this story, thought Benjamin was like, I don't know, 10 or 12. No, he's in his late 20s, so like 27, 28. Okay, but he's still being coddled by Jacob because it's his favorite son. He's like, no, you can't take him. He's overprotecting, treating him like a child because of his own trauma. And then we see Reuben promises. He promises on the life of his own children that he's going to make sure Benjamin is okay in order to bring back Simeon. And Jacob says this, verse 38, my son will not go down there with you. His brother is dead, and he is the only one left. Man, imagine being Reuben, saying like, Dad, I promise I'm going to make this happen. I'll protect my younger brother, and him saying, no, he's the only son I have left. Even Jacob, the patriarch, the great man of God, is battling a generational trauma that in turn affects Reuben and the others as they are discarded and essentially told they're worthless. When pain is not processed and placed into the hands of God, it becomes a prison that not only confines you but confines the people around you. When your pain does not go into God's hands and is not processed through him for healing, it doesn't just affect you, it doesn't just make you get you stuck, but it gets the people around you stuck. And so I'm here tonight to tell somebody, let the testimony of Jacob stand before you, and no, not the testimony of his faith, the testimony of his scars. Read this story and realize it's time to let go and release your pain and release your trauma to God. It's time. Don't get to the point of old age to where you've carried the baggage and the trauma and the unforgiveness and the bitterness to the point to where it's affecting your future generations and the people around you that should be blessed and led by you and influenced by you, but you're so bitter and so tied up, okay? Let that testimony of Jacob speak to you tonight. It's time to let go right now and release your pain to God. Generational trauma, maybe it didn't stop at your parents, but it can stop with you. Yeah? Maybe it got past you, but it can stop at you. They may not have submitted it to God, but you can. They may not have asked for healing, but you can. They may not have forgiven, but you can. They may not have sought accountability, but you can. They may not have testified to the Lord's goodness in the pain, but you can. Come on, somebody. There is time in this moment in your life. It is not too late to surrender everything that you have been through. It is not too late. If you're at the very beginning of the journey of getting to the other side, you can continue. You can start that journey right now tonight. Y'all, get up on your feet. Help me close. Get up on your feet. Stand up with me. A life on the other side is a life with Jesus. Right? There is no other side without Jesus. I don't know where that is. I don't want to go. I don't want to travel through any journey of healing that doesn't end up with me in intimacy with Jesus Christ, the one who knew all of my pain, the one who has borne everything that I have borne, and he carried it with him, and he ended up at forgiveness, and he ended up at strength, and he ended up at life. I don't want to be anywhere else at the end of the journey. I don't want to hit any other side that's not with Jesus. 1 Peter Chapter 1, verse 3, Peter writes this, according to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. In this, look at this, in this, you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it's tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Come on, somebody. It is through Jesus that we have a living hope that trumps trauma and pain and suffering and hopelessness and betrayal and disappointment and sickness. We have a living hope for now, and we have an eternal inheritance for tomorrow. Strength for today and bright hope for tomorrow by the work of Jesus, and it is in this we rejoice. And the only way we cross to the other side of suffering with joy and with healing and with peace is to keep eyes fixed on Jesus. If you're comfortable, will you close your eyes? Because I want you to not look at me for a second, and I want you, as best you can, to look on Jesus. So close your eyes if you're comfortable doing that. Listen. You don't need me to tell you this because you know this already. Everyone in here already knows this. But let me just remind you. Grief, suffering, loss, pain, these things are not always linear. As in, it's not always an easy progression from step one to step two, point A to B. We don't just get healing in a single altar call moment. So as I'm talking about generational trauma and I'm talking about the idea of getting to the other side of suffering, it may be part of you kind of scoffs to yourself, like, well, I've quote-unquote surrendered that. I've tried the altar call thing and it didn't really work. But let me tell you, remember how I told you I shattered my elbow in fifth grade? It's been 20 plus years since that bone quote-unquote healed, but the other day I just bumped it onto something and I crumpled in pain. It hurt so bad. And the funny thing was, like, I really didn't even hit it that hard. It's just sensitive. It's not the same as before it was broken. It's different now. So Joseph receives his healing, and he goes through this amazing process of forgiveness that's already begun, but he isn't ever actually the same. The pain changed him. The pain will change you. So you may be healing or healed and still bump into something in just the wrong way and cringe in pain. And the key for Joseph and for you and me is to make this journey and to commit to this journey to the other side with eyes forever fixed on Jesus, not expecting that it's going to be exactly like it was before, not expecting that it's not going to be a little sensitive sometimes, that you're not going to need his help from time to time, because it's not linear, but instead knowing that even though it's different and you have some new scars now, where Jesus is leading you is always better. It's always better. Listen, it's a process. Following Jesus is a process. Letting him change you, letting him heal you, letting him restore you and strengthen you so that what was meant for evil becomes for good. This is a journey, and it takes consistent discipleship under your master. Under your rabbi. It takes practice of the spiritual disciplines. It takes submission to his written word. It takes refusing to look at the wind and the waves, no matter how threatening they seem, and to keep your eyes on him every day. Now, I'm not going to keep your eyes closed if you're comfortable with that. Go ahead and love Randy and Brennan, come join me. We're going to do a little bit more worship, and I'm not going to contradict what I just said and tell you that you need to come up to the altar for your moment of healing, but do you need to take the next step in the journey of healing? Maybe some of you, do you need to take the first step? Or maybe, like I said at the beginning, maybe someone, you're in a place where you're like, I would love it, and it's just not happening. The answer is the same. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. look full in his wonderful face. And the things of earth grow strangely dim in the light of his glorious grace. Turn your eyes on Jesus tonight. Focus on him. Embrace the journey. Not just, Jesus, where are you right now in this moment, but Jesus, where are you taking me? Jesus, where are you leading me? Where are we going? And it doesn't matter if I didn't plan it. It doesn't matter if I don't understand it. To get to the other side, I go with Jesus.